we had a few problems with the new age computer stuff, but it's all cleared now, hopefully. So here's what I'm going to do. My major thought in thinking about the presentation has been two fantastic breakthrough papers by Linda LaRouche. Then I need the mic higher up, okay? So, one is occurring in EIR in December, called Towards a New Westphalia Treaty, the Coming Eurasia World. And the second one, which appeared in January, is Dialogue of Civilizations, Earth's Next 50 Years. And I will highly recommend for every one of you not only to read these two articles once, but twice, three times, and discuss it with each other. They will greatly change your way of thinking. LaRouche in these two papers are addressing each one of us as a statesman or a stateswoman, and he is it's a whole new thrust that LaRouche is throwing out in these two papers. We are looking at the very dangerous strategic situation we have today, and you heard Jeff this morning, and you all been briefed before you came up here this weekend, that we must have, defeat Bush's and company's plan for privatizing the Social Security. We must make Bush a lame duck now, and we must have a new international financial and monetary system, a new Bretton Woods system. That's all fine and good. Let's say we do all that. This is not enough, and that's why it's very important that you study and think and discuss these two papers. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to discuss some of these ideas that are in these two papers. Not a lot compared to what is these two papers. I'm just going to skim the surface. Then I'm going to go through some of the most crucial ideas from two of China's great giants, Confucius and Sun Yat-sen, and the ideas that they laid regarding Chinese civilization and culture. And then I'm going to discuss, in the end, the recent history in Asia and in China particularly, for where are the problems. With discussions, I don't have all the answers and so forth. So that's kind of my outline. And so if we do all that, make Bush lame, get a new financial and monetary international system, that's not enough. LaRouche calls for that. What we need is a concert of nations that are engaging in a dialogue of cultures. And that has to be done around a common principle. He says we must create a new Eurasian culture of collaboration between Europe and Asia and beyond. Of course, with the key ingredients being the very best traditions from the United States. LaRouche emphasizes again and again, without the United States, we are not going to have any change for the good in the world. And that is our role here in the United States to make sure that this indeed happens over the next weeks and months ahead. So, already hundreds of years ago, in 1687, a great mentor of Linda LaRouche, namely Leibniz, he was very interested in China. Actually, the last 30 years of Leibniz's life, he corresponded with European missionaries in China and he studied Chinese way of thinking, their ideology, and so forth. Because he said, in 1687, he said, what is necessary is that the great old cultures of Europe and Asia stretch out their arms and cultivate and civilize the area in between and develop it. And so that is what LaRouche calls for today. But it's not enough just to have certain square solutions. You have to think much more in depth how it's actually going to function? How are we going to do so that it doesn't fail? And that's where LaRouche's two articles comes in, and that's why they are so important. So in these papers, and I'm going to read up a couple of quotes, which you might like to discuss later on, because LaRouche is very provocative regarding going against the grain of current thinking in universities and other institutions today. He says, quote, Asian cultures generally lack any philosophical grounding in the historically specific principles upon which the concept of the modern sovereign nation states depends. They don't have it in Asia, LaRouche says. They lack the grounding for having a sovereign nation state, a modern sovereign nation state. The grounding is not in Asian cultures. And that is very important, because if you want to have a concert of nation states collaborating around a common principle for development, what about Asia, where the majority of the world's population live, if they don't have a grounding in those principles? And he goes through certain key ideas why this is the case. And one of the things is that in European history, for the last 2,000 plus years, there has been an intense, crucial fight regarding the view of man. Is man a beast, a subject? You can just treat any way you want. The rulers can treat any way you want, because man is just like a cow, just with two legs instead of four. Or is man something very special? That has been a fight where the vector of that fight has been to fight against usury, to fight against that a few would use the many as slave labor and use the manipulations financially to do so. In this fight, there's been ups and downs, but there's been, I'm not going to go through over 2,000 years of European history, but from Solon till Louis XI in France in the 15th century, you had major jumps in European cultures, which made finally the foundation with Louis XI for a modern sovereign nation state, where for the first time, which is a crucial, crucial feature, that what happened with Louis XI's state was for the first time this to take care of the general welfare, of the common good, was the responsibility of the state. So from being ideas that several good people had before that time, this was not the policy of a government. And part of that fight, very important, was Dante Alighieri in Italy, leading up to a very important historical individual, namely Joan of Arc, who was crucial in enabling, which is a whole presentation in itself, we can discuss it later on, but was crucial in enabling Louis XI to form this first sovereign republic. Nation state. Part of the fight that she was in was that through her courage, she stood up against the most nasty oligarchy network at that time, against Venice and Venice tentacles and their collaborators in the church. Like the key judges in the trial that condemned Joan of Arc to be burned alive. The key judge was first representing the Bourbons and then the English later on in a number of councils that took place in Europe. You had the Council of Constance and the Council of Basel, and then you had the Council of Florence. And this took place over decades, where you had discussions. Actually, it was like a cultural warfare in these different councils. And the reason for the different names was they moved from different cities. So it was in Constance, it was in Basel, and then it was moved to Florence in Italy. And So you had really nasty figures, as I said, nasty figures in the church representing the oligarchy. And then you had a giant at that time, namely Kusa, who was key in the networks that had been part of the fight that Joan of Arc had launched. And Kusa in Florence in 1439 is a crucial year. The Council of Florence in 1439. And it's crucial for what we talk about regarding making a foundation for creating the possibilities for a modern nation state, sovereign nation states, the which LaRouche says that Asian cultures don't have yet today. At that council, which is again a whole big story, but at that council where people from all over, from East and West, convenes and discuss the nature of man and what should be the credo of the church, they decide upon a idea of the filioque. Which means, filio means son, and kve means end. And what is being, for the first time, being absolutely crystal clear and outlined, although it had been before in the fight from Solon and up, and actually earlier than that, but from Solon and up, where we know it for sure, that man is something very special. So what the filioque signifies, and that this has been decided to put into the credo of the church, is that the Holy Spirit, God, and Jesus is consubstantial. That the Holy Spirit, reason, comes from the Father and the Son. Where you, for the first time, it was made totally clear that Jesus, which is man, signifying man and God's Son, that he has certain things totally in common with the Creator and the Holy Spirit, with reason. Consubstantiality between Jesus, the Creator, and the Holy Spirit. And this had never been made so clear before. So therefore, this was a total victory for the forces believing that man is the living image of the Creator, that man should participate, it's man's duty to participate in the creation process. That is, to make clear what was in the book of Genesis, go out, multiply, subdue the earth, and take dominion over it. I don't know it so well in English.
Replenish
it, and subdue it, and take dominion over it. No?
Go for it, multiply, replenish it, and subdue it.
Okay.
Go for it.
It says, and God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it.
Thanks. Oh, this is in the back of the book. Okay. So that was made very clear with the Council of Florence. And that then led into Louis XI and ahead. So another very provocative statement by LaRouche that we can take up later for discussion if people want to. He says the following. The reciprocal concept of the respective natures and relationship between the Creator and the human individual, what I just touched upon, is the only premise which makes possible a durable ecumenical agreement among European and Asian cultures. The only premise which gives the Asian cultures a treaty which they could rightly trust. He also in another place says it must be based on such a dialogue of cultures must be based on, therefore, monotheism, in the belief of one creator and not a lot of different gods, which we can discuss later if people so wish. So one of the problems, LaRouche says, is that one of the problems of Asian cultures today is that through many centuries they have been raped. And by the people, by the forces in the West that were the usurious forces, the oligarchical financier forces in the West. And that is what Asia has tasted together with Africa in very big mouthfuls through centuries through many centuries, where the vector of struggle in Europe was against usury for man's role as the co-creator, as God's right arm. This was not the case in Asia. This was not the vector for the struggle in Asia. But instead, what Asia had for centuries was an imposition from outside through colonialism of the worst side, the usurious side in the West. And that side, of course, is that there's absolutely that man is just like a beast that can be used any way you want to. I mean, let me just give you one example. When the British dominated major parts of China, you had parks in Shanghai, where outside of the parks it would say, in China, in Shanghai, it would say, Chinese and dogs not allowed. But there's many, many examples. So you have that, and then either a certain lack of development, and where you are beginning to have some modern economic development that has been imported from outside. It's not part of the cultural development and the struggle in India or in China that there is modern economic development. It has been imported from outside, and the underlying thing, the underlying ideas of man as being the living image of a creator, of the creator, or that we should go out and subdue the earth and take dominion over it because of that, that is not inherent in the culture. So which is really the basis for the best ideas regarding economic development and the American system of political economy. So in addition to that, LaRouche points out that the last 40 years in particular, what the United States and Europe has done to themselves concerning destruction, cultural destruction and destruction of civilization, that they have given to Asia too. So for example, if you talk with people in China or in India, they, for example, don't see anything different from the American system political economy and what we have today. There's no differentiation. The West is all like one thing. And when you have had, if you think about for centuries that you have had colonization, and then you adopt things that you want economic development to become independent and so forth. But most of what you have seen has been and experienced has just been that the West, so to speak, are treating humans like cattle, and the way the Asians has experienced it. Then that also prevents cultures in Asia, and the same is for Africa, to look at what is problems in their own cultures. Because one of the great problems in civilizations today is that if you don't look at what is wrong with your own culture and then try to change it, then you will fail and you'll go down. And that's one of the things that LaRouche warns about a lot. When we're going to have a dialogue of cultures today, that one of the big problems, and you've seen it all at the United Nations, and it's that also what people, the way people discuss at the universities, that you have to respect people's traditional cultures. You have to respect the, what are they called in Australia?
Aborigines.
The Aborigines and their culture. You have to respect the Indian American cultures in the United States, put them into reservations, run gambling and cheap cigarettes, and then give them a lot of alcohol. Right, and that's there. No, but that's what is being done, but you have to respect them. You don't want people to have a great education and be assimilated into new developments because you have to respect their traditions. You have also to have a consensus about, we all, like, we're sitting down now, European leaders with Asian leaders, and then we are getting a consensus, so you can have your ideas and we have our ideas, and then don't ruffle any feathers. And this is death. This must not happen in the future collaboration and discussions ahead. Again, it's why it's very important for you to study these two articles by LaRouche, because I'm going to, what I'm saying today is very little compared to what is contained in those two articles. So LaRouche, one time, 13 years ago, regarding this about how you have a really bad adoption of the worst sides of the West, was I visited LaRouche in jail with two Chinese people, and he was very serious, and it stuck in my mind, and I'll never forget it, because LaRouche looked at the Chinese and he said, there's two things from the West that is going to sweep Asia like fire on dry wood. And he said, one of them is AIDS. And indeed, AIDS is on a very high rise in China and India. The second, he said, is that it will sweep like fire on dry wood, is that Asia will adopt the worst features. They don't know anything else. They will adopt the worst features of the West and make it into their own, and then make it even more degraded. And that indeed is what you see today. If you want a hip-hop scene, the real hip-hoppers today, you go to Tokyo. Leona told me that when the Taiwan youth wants to really be in the really news, in the way that really goes on, where it's really hot, they go to Tokyo. So please keep in your mind just these things I threw out here, because I'm going to come back to them in the end. What I would like to do now is to go through some of the most crucial, beautiful ideas from China. And there's many others to take. Again, I'm skimming the surface, so to speak, more to get an idea where changes need to be made, including in the way that we think about it. I think that the youth today, a lot will think like Asians in terms of a lack of understanding of where the United States came from and what is the essence of the European struggle. So let's go with the first. Let's now go with this fantastic system here. All right. Oh no. Okay, it'll take 2 minutes. So I'm going to talk first about the Socrates for large part of Asia, namely Confucius or Kongzi. And he was born in 551 BC. It became up in the 70s, an old man at that time. And he was born in a period that's called the Warring States period. It was a period in China which was of great social upheaval. I mean, it's like, it's not comparable, but it's like a 30 years war in Europe, where people were just, the different states were just fighting each other, and who was suffering, of course, was people. And often you have such horrendous periods, that's where great people rise to the occasions that become greater than they might have thought. And Kongzi was one of these great people who became a philosopher king, to use Plato's words. And he's like known in Asia today. No, it's not just China, but in Japan, Korea, and other nations. as the great philosopher, as the great educator. There's a lot of slanders against him. So you'll have to study him yourself to figure out if for yourself how he thinks. But he's known as the great educator, like Socrates, going out and teach. And that's what he did his entire life. His first teaching job he got when he was 20. And he sought also to help the different rulers at the time. And at one point...
What's going on?
At one point, he is the helper, the advisor to a ruler in the state of Lu. How long will it take? Okay, because I want to show you a map. And this state of Lu is, after Confucius start advising them and so forth, they become very prosperous, they're flourishing, and the neighboring states become very nervous. Because if Lu becomes strong, then Lu is probably going to gobble them up or something like that. They not knowing how Confucius thinks, because Confucius doesn't think about the survival of the fittest at all, but he thinks about the common good. But they think that. They are discussing different ways how to get the ruler of Lu not to listen to Confucius. So what they do is, just many different ways. Through history, it's money, sex, and drugs. Many people that could have been much better have been lured by money, sex, and drugs. And so, not Confucius. They know they can't get him. It's like it'll be difficult to get Socrates with those things. Or you can think about a guy like Linda LaRouche today. I mean, you can send him a bunch of women and drugs and money, and he wouldn't really care about that, right? But the ruler of Lu, what they do is it's absurd even to think about, right? So, each one of you should be so that the enemy will think it absurd even to try to lure you with anything of earthly, physical lusts and pleasures. So, these neighboring states, what they do, they send 80 beautiful girls and 120 horses as a gift to the ruler of Lu. And horses play a very important role. I mean, there was one ruler in China's history who had 40,000 horses, and you'll get the horses to dance for you. Also, horses have it's also symbolizing gentlemen. So if you have Chinese paintings with horses which have a special expression in their faces, which is like symbols, then they're symbols of noblemen. So this ruler got, I'm just trying to talk while we get this machine to function. So let me backtrack, okay? Because to this, I said before that Confucius is known as being a great educator. And every year in different places in Asia, and very much in Taipei, and actually two places in Taiwan, they're celebrating Confucius' birthday. I went there one year. The celebration is before the sun gets up. So you go there at 4:30 in the morning, and then there's all kind of dances and music in specific costumes as on Confucius' time. And then the different ministers come and they have to throw down their entire body on the ground, and they are kowtowing in that way to Confucius, and the ideas of Confucius have to promise to be good leaders, to be truthful and to be moral and so forth. And this is from 2 years ago in Taiwan, the yearly celebration of Confucius' birthday. And this is Confucius. A very great scholar, and he had these things on. You'll see in Chinese paintings, sometimes they hang down. This is their hats they wear. That means that they are a scholar. So if you see a Chinese painting and they have strange things hanging down, black things, that signifies they are a scholar. Next. And that is where this yellow area you see in China, this is northern China. Here you have Shanghai. This is Yangtze River. So you have a little place where it is. So the yellow area, this is where he run around and taught. And you can see the state of Lu which I just talked about, where they sent 80 beautiful women and 120 horses. And Confucius is waiting and waiting because he hopes this ruler gets to his senses. But after 3 days, the ruler is completely engulfed in these ladies and the horses. So Confucius leaves. And a guy asked him after he left, he said, what did Confucius do when he left? And he answered, he sang a song. And this is the song that he sang.
I'm not going to sing it because there's no notes. It's not written as a song, but these are the lyrics to the song. It says, beware of a woman's tongue. Sooner or later, you'll get stung. Beware of a woman's visit. Sooner or later, you'll get it. Hey ho, hey ho. I'm going to run away.
Which is what he did. So, he travels around in this area. He teaches and he edits the old Chinese classics. That is, he takes books that are from 3000 BC on poetry, on history, on rituals. And he looks at all these old books, and then he thinks about how to give the future of China some advice, to take the very best from Chinese history from the way back and give it to people through editing these classics. They call the five classics. And for example, if you look at the Xu Jing, which is the book of history, he will take all kinds of examples. For example, he talk about a guy called Yao, who's, I don't know the tone, Yao. Do you know the tone of Yao? So I don't know if it's Yao, 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 but it's one of them. And he lived 2,900 BC, and he was very good. Confucius writes about what Yao did. There was bad, the animals controlled everything. And there was swamp, just like rainforest and so forth. So Yao came in there, and he regulated the waters. He made he made so there was not marsh anymore. He drained it. He made canals. He made sure people could till the land, and the beasts didn't control it anymore. People built nice dwellings and so forth. And Confucius say we should learn from that. And then he gives other examples. Then came another ruler. And he was just into his own lusts and eating and pleasures and so forth, and he ignored the people, and therefore the animals started coming back, being controlled again, people were starving, and we began to have flooding and so forth because the ruler didn't care about the welfare of the people. So Confucius will take all these examples from the history from the past and edit that. And then, as I mentioned, he also have a beautiful book around called the Book of Poetry, taking ancient Chinese poetry, editing it, commenting upon it, and so forth. So those five books are known today. I mean, they're regarded by Chinese scholars as like the Iliad and the Odyssey, where you really get an idea from the past, like the Vedic hymns from India. And around Confucius, he just travels around. His key thing is to teach, to edit the classics and to teach. And he has 72 very close people around him, like disciples. And then he has around 3,000 other people that he teaches. And the center of everything he teaches is that the nature of man is good. I repeat, the central point, the view of man of Confucius is the nature of man is good. And there is four moral elements that Confucius teaches that every single one of us is born with. Every single baby is born with four moral elements. As you are born with four limbs, you are born with four moral elements. And it is your duty to develop those four elements. And they are up there on the screen. And the first one is love, Ren. And this is the higher notion of love. like you have in the Bible, charity or agape. It's not anything to do with the body. And that idea also includes the notion of the love of man. Actually, you have like two, you have, it is indicated in the character without me going into details about that. Then you have the other one is E, righteousness, which includes the notion of justice and love of justice. Then you have Li, which is propriety, which means how you deal socially, how you conduct yourself, how you relate yourself to your parents and your brothers, your neighbors, and so forth. A little bit like what you have in the Ten Amendments. Don't steal. Commandments. What do you call them?
Commandments.
Oh no, don't steal. Don't look with lust at your neighbor's wife. Honor your father and mother, and so forth. So this is, goes in under propriety. And then jur, wisdom, which include the love of knowledge. So Confucius says that every single man, every single baby is born with these four moral elements. And that it is your duty to develop those four elements. Confucius says, if you don't develop those four elements that you were born with, then you're playing thief with yourself. You're stealing from yourself. You have these capabilities, and therefore you should develop them. It is your duty as a man, as a person, to develop those capabilities. And then he has a very interesting thing I find. I wrote this character underneath, Cheng, which means free of deceit. And Confucius says that the only way you can develop these capabilities that you have been born with is through Cheng. That is, you have to be free of deceit. And everyone knows that if you're fooling around, I mean, you can kind of, it looks like you're doing serious work. You can kind of put out a good facade. But you always know with yourself if you are bullshitting, to put another word. Children knows it. I mean, you can fool maybe your mother, but the child knows itself if it's not doing right. Huh? And therefore, the only way, there's no way in which you can just study and so forth and not care about your fellow human beings. There's no way around. You had to be truthful. You had to be free of deceit. There's no way in which you can develop love, love of justice, righteousness, love of mankind, love of justice, and so forth, love of knowledge. There's no way you can do that if you have to masturbate every night with pornography magazines, or you have to steal out and go to a rave party. There's no way you can. You have to be free of deceit. You have to really go for a human path where you don't deceive yourself. You can deceive everybody else, but the one that you are really, really bad to is yourself. So, and everybody knows this is true. Yes? They are right there. Oh, Ren Yi Li Zhi. Actually, this is love and righteousness, love of justice, propriety, that is how you deal with your common fellow being, and wisdom, which is also love of knowledge. So those are that you are born with as a person, which you can see a dog is not born with those small elements. So, Confucius say, and I'm going to read some quotes because I want you to know that this is him saying it, and he says it in a different way that we would say it today. So, some of the quotes I will read twice, so to make sure you get it. Confucius says, what is God-given? he doesn't say God, he says Tien, which means heaven, but that's what he means. What is God-given is what we call human nature. To fulfill the law of our human nature is what we call moral law. Yes? Oh, okay. So, that is, what is God-given, that's our human nature. That is, we are in the likeness of heaven. We're in the likeness of God. God. That is our human nature. Everything that goes to the bestial side is not our human nature. So what is God-given, what is heavenly given, given by heaven, is our human nature. Then, so I said before, key thing, Confucius says, the nature of man is good. Second very important thing he says is that love is the most important element in human nature. He says you can have everything else, but if you have not love, nothing else counts. So that's also the first point that was is written up there. And that's the first point that Confucius, when he writes about it, takes up. And he says about love, he says a lot of things about love. I just took out a couple of quotes. He says, love is the leader and home of all virtues, and it is necessary to practice it with all one's might. Love is man's mind, man's soul, and righteousness is man's path. I'll read that again. Love is the leader and home of all virtues, and it is necessary to practice it with all one's might. Love is man's mind, man's soul, and righteousness is man's path. Path, P-A-T-H. That's my accent. So anytime you don't understand me, please ask. So the soul is clearly more important than the path. Huh? So this is the next quote I have is concerning love. He says all the time it's the most pervading principle, and you have to realize it. And he says, the people are in need of love more urgently than water or fire. The principle of love should be applied to the governing as well as to the governed. That is, it should be all pervading in the society. If you read Paul's letters to the Corinthians about love, it's a very similar notion. I didn't have it with me for some different reasons. So, but if you read it, if you have no love, you can have everything else. You're like a empty vessel without love. That is, you can read, you can do all kinds of things. If you have no love, you have nothing. And that is also what Confucius say. That is, you can try to be righteous, deal good, and so forth with your fellow human being, and you can study and think, but if you have no love, none of these other three elements will function. So, another important thing that Confucius says, and I'm only taking the most important things. He says, freedom is the pursuit of truth. Freedom is the pursuit of truth. Not freedom to do whatever. Freedom is not to do whatever you want to do. Hug a lamppost, whatever you can do. Just free to do whatever you want to do, whenever the lust comes over you, of lust for one thing or the other. No, that's not freedom. He's very, very similar to Friedrich Schiller, the German poet of freedom, in his thinking about man. Schiller will say actually almost exactly the same as Confucius regarding a number of things, including freedom is the pursuit of truth. This is what creates truly human freedom on the highest level, and happiness in the Nietzschean sense of being happy. So Confucius says that when you the result of freedom from all deception, cheng, if you enlist cheng, so that you can develop your capabilities. Then he says, only he who is fully true to himself can assist the transforming and nourishing powers of heaven and earth. That is, you can only take part of the creation process if you are true to yourself. That is, if you are striving to be godlike, to become more and more human. I'll repeat. Only he who is fully true to himself can assist the transforming and nourishing powers of heaven and earth. Able to assist the transforming and nourishing powers of heaven and earth, he may with heaven and earth form eternion. That is, he will participate in the creation process with what laws that is the universal laws that is given, using his creative powers, his cognitive capabilities, he can participate in transforming and nourishing the universe. That is, he is the Creator's right arm, the living image of the Creator, if you want to put other words in. But that is what Confucius say, what I just read up. Form with heaven and earth eternion, in transforming and nourishing everything between heaven and earth. So he says further, he who is naturally true to himself is one who, without effort, hits upon what is right. One whose life is easily and naturally in harmony with natural law, and such a person we call a man of divine nature. That is, you don't have to struggle with it, it just comes naturally. And that is very, very similar to the idea that Schiller has on a beautiful soul, where Schiller's or Plato's a golden soul. But Schiller says about a beautiful soul how that is a person who has developed to such a degree that what is necessary to do is also what you want to do. So you never have to be scared of doing something wrong, because what is necessary and what you want to do is one and the same thing. And Confucius says in different words, he thinks you have not like Plato says to be 60 to become on a level of reason and becoming a beautiful soul. Confucius says that at 70, it takes 70 years to get there. And he says to himself, about himself, at 70, I could follow what my heart desired without transgressing what was right. So he has actually, when you are 30, you're beginning to become an adult. When you're 40, you're a man. And then when you're 50 and 60, and then at 70, you can get to a level of reason if you work on it. I'm sorry, we should. What? Excuse me? You can go. Then he says, Confucius says, man relates to the universe through moral law. Man relates to the universe through moral law. He says, quote, the life of the moral man is an exemplification of the universal moral order. The life of the moral man is an exemplification of the universal moral order. Because man is the person, because he, the moral man, is the person who unceasingly cultivates his true self or moral being. And to find the central clue to our moral being, which unites us to the universal order, that indeed is the highest human attainment. In the book of history that I mentioned before, one of the five classics, I'll just take some of the key things for an ideal Confucian state. Key aspects if you are going to have an ideal Confucian state. If you are a leader, what should the leadership do? The leadership is commanded to first, one, work for the general welfare of the people. One, work for the general welfare of the people. He actually doesn't say general, that's me being interested. Work for the welfare of the people, so forget general. Work for the welfare of the people. Two, be frugal. Huh. And, I mean, people that have a lot of money, today they go through gambling, stealing, or inheritance. But also people that want money and needs to have a lot of money, it's always, also today, iffy, if you can trust such a person. And it was interesting, many people in Taiwan loves Jiang Jingguo, who was Chiang Kai-shek's son, who became leader after Chiang Kai-shek died. And they really liked him because in the Chinese culture, you have a lot of praise of being rich. But he was not like that. And he's very known for not being corrupt. And he would always go out and eat at the places where people would eat, like noodle soup for a buck and things like that. And he is also famous for, if he wanted to promote a person, like to a government position or a general in the military and so forth, he would go out unannounced and visit those people. And if he found that they were too rich and surrounding themselves with too many earthly goods, they would not be promoted. He did not trust such people. He trusted people that were frugal. And it was very Confucian in his outlook in that respect. So frugal. And then that if you are a leader, you should view your position as a trust given to you by heaven. That is where heaven is a reflection of natural order. And one more point, there's many points, but I just took out some of the key ones, that you have to keep harmony between social and natural order. That is, if you are a leader, you've been given the mandate from heaven. And you have heard this, to lose the mandate from heaven. That is, if you for a while violate natural law, if you do awful things, at a certain point, you're going to lose the mandate to lead. It can also you can also see it in if you have stupid or evil rules regarding that you don't care about the people, you don't care about tilling the soil, like you don't care about the deserts are growing because there's no cultivation of the land and no irrigation and so forth, it's going to get back at you. You cannot violate the mandate from heaven. And if you're a leader, you will be given that mandate, and if you violate it at a certain point, you're going to be punished in one way or the other, or people are going to be punished. You cannot violate that. But for a ruler, if you are in a ruling position, you must obey the mandate of heaven. Otherwise, you have a civilization collapse. So, also, at Confucius' time, you had people that say the nature of man is evil. So Confucius was heavily in debates with people because he said the nature of man is good. You had people saying survival of the fittest, that each one for himself. And a guy who took all of Confucius' teachings and taught them, Mencius, who lived 100 years later, he writes in one of his writings, he says, look, regarding the people in charge in leadership positions, he says, in their kitchens there is fat meat, in their stables there are fat horses, but their people have the look of hunger, and on the wilds there are those who have died of famine. This is leading on beasts to devour men, and to men to devour one another. And he says this is a violation of the mandate of heaven and that people have to follow the teachings of Confucius, to follow the mandate of heaven. Otherwise, you have such a destruction of civilization. There's a whole lengthy thing which you can have a great delight in studying yourself, and that is what Confucius actually says about education. He's for universal education. He's for that the key thing in education is to develop moral character and to ennoble the individual student. If you think about that, he says that the nature of man is good, love is the key of the virtues and the moral elements you are born with. Then you can imagine his education, his way of thinking about education. So don't just take my words that I'm saying that this is what he's saying. Study it. Study what he has to say of education. It's quite fascinating. He will say also, you know, what makes people criminal if they have a low living standard and no education. So you cannot punish people that are unequal treated in society because they are made criminals because they have never gotten education and they are poor. So don't punish them a second time. So, which is exactly what we do today in the United States and also increasingly in Europe. So a very important part in developing people is music. And this is a drawing, so to speak, of Confucius playing the Chinese music instrument. But he says, and he has a whole lot to say about music. I'm just giving you a couple of excerpts. Music rises from the human heart and is connected with the principles of human conduct. Therefore, the music of a peaceful and prosperous country is quiet and joyous, and the government is orderly. The music of a country in turmoil shows dissatisfaction and anger, and the government is chaotic. When lewd, exciting, and upsetting music prevails, we know that the people are immoral. Thus, we see music and government are directly connected with one another. When lewd, exciting, and upsetting music prevails, we know that the people are immoral. Thus, we see music and government are directly connected with one another. Therefore, the superior man tries to create harmony in the human heart by rediscovery of human nature. When such music prevails and the people's mind are led towards the right ideals and aspirations, we may see the appearance of a great nation. You'll see some example of that, what the LaRouche Youth Movement is doing. You heard practicing and so forth was always used last night, and we are going to have a music panel tonight where this is exactly directed by LaRouche, what the LaRouche Youth Movement is doing internationally to set people's heart straight through learning and developing character through music, which is a very special language for development and language for destruction. So the other very special, there's many, many good people in China, but the two giants in my view are Confucius and then the next gentleman, Sun Yat-sen. And here he looks very serious. So we take another one. This one. At his work desk. I like this picture a lot. So he was born in 1866. Next. Oh, this is not very clear. This is southern China. It'd be much more clear overhead. Where we have Hong Kong. Here is Hong Kong. So if you have an idea of China, Hong Kong is down here, and that is southern China. That's where Sun Yat-sen was born. And next, his entire life learned from a great statesman and economist Friedrich List and Lincoln, and then from China, Confucius. Confucius was Sun Yat-sen's key mentor concerning from Chinese history and culture, and he uses him constantly. Like, this is Sun Yat-sen's handwriting, Qian Xia Wei Gong, and this comes from Confucius, written by him, by Sun Yat-sen. He used a lot of slogans, using key sayings in his propaganda work for the revolution of China. And I'll show you something later where you can see where this comes from. This means, Qian Xia Wei Gong, means that you have, it's your duty as a human being to serve everything under heaven. Qian Xia, Qian means heaven, Xia, under heaven. where you're going. You have to serve everything under heaven. And that's your duty. It's like your duty, like what Confucius say, you have to develop your capabilities that you've been born with, like your four limbs. And now, being a human, you have to serve, being a human being, not just eat, drink, sleep, have sex, like a dog. So, when Sun Yat-sen is 13 years old, he masters the five classics. Remember I said about the five Confucius five classics, like being like the Iliad and the Odyssey? Well, some of you might have read how LaRouche, when he was 12, he mastered Leibniz. So Sun Yat-sen, when he's 13, masters the five classics of Confucius. And when he's 13, he goes to Hawaii, which is very important. He was a Buddhist before he left, and he goes to and had just been in China, and he goes to Hawaii, where he is for 4 years. And he is a changed man when he comes back. He comes back in 1885. He's 19 years old. And actually, when he's 18, a half year earlier, he has written to the Empress of China and said, look, we need some changes in this country because people are suffering. And he makes a number of proposals for changes. And he never gets an answer back. So half a year later, when he's 19 years old, he decides, he's 19, it's a gigantic country, China, with an emperor. And you had emperors for several thousand years. It had had a very, and you had had colonialism from the West and so forth. And now through all this period, you had an emperor. And you had hundreds of thousands of poor people working like slaves, illiterate and so forth. A country that never kind of got a sense where people, if you're a poor peasant having lived on the soil where hundreds of years your family lived and you just thought about survival, you don't have a sense of a nation. So this is the nation that Sun Yat-sen decides at 19 years old that since the emperor is not listening to his ideas about changes for the people of China, that he is going to organize a revolution in China and overthrow the emperor of China. And he does that. But that's the same kind of commitment each one of us should have, or must have, for making Bush a lame duck and getting a concert of nations, which is vital for the survival and development of civilization today. And that is the determination and passion he has, and that's why he succeeds. So in the next 8 years, he's studying medicine in Hong Kong, and he's recruiting. And it takes him 8 years to recruit three other guys. They're called the Four Arc Rebels. They're like the key rebels, the key leader team. And Sun Yat-sen is the second at the left. It's the Four Arc Rebels. And you have a tremendous situation at that time for China, because you have France, England, Russia, Germany takes chunk of China. I was supposed to have a map and I don't have it, but if you go and look at a historical map at the end of the 19th century, you will see, if you have a map of China, you'll see how chunks of China, all of China is occupied, either controlled, influenced by, or directly occupied by foreign powers. And then you have this impotent emperor and the people are suffering. At the same time, in 1894, Japan invades China. So it's a very dangerous situation. Yes?
How old are they in that
picture? It is between 1885 and 1893. So they're between 18 and 26. I don't know. I can look it up. I have them. But so in 1895, 10 years after he has decided to overthrow, that the emperor must go and he's going to lead the revolution, they have the first failure. And in the first battle, two of these two comrades die. And in from 1896 to year 1900, he travels 6 times around the globe, Sun Yat-sen, to organize support all over the world from non-Chinese, but very specifically in Chinese communities all over the world, to support in the revolution of China, to have support networks, to organize military training, to organize money. He single-handedly is the key number one fundraiser for the revolution of China, getting money from all over the world to succeed in China. If you think about what I said about what the situation is in China, it would be pretty complicated to raise money in China. So he goes to Chinese outside of China, Japan, France, U.S., Germany, and raises money. And in Hawaii, you have Chinese soldiers being trained by a Danish captain. And anyway, let's take the next one. This is the revolutionary group formed in Paris with Sun Yat-sen, next. In Vancouver and in Chicago, next. In San Francisco, next. This is a key revolutionary working with Sun Yat-sen, and this is the 4 newspapers that he starts. And the 3 first get shut down, but the last one still exists. And then he starts up a new one, but the last one still exists when the revolution is won. And from 1900, so he travels 96 to year 1900 to organize all over the world for the revolution. And can we have the next? Yeah, this is impossible. Okay, forget about that. So from 1900 to 1905, there is a marked change in China regarding support for the revolution. You have a massive increased poverty, but the key thing is increased student and young people participating and being trained by Sun Yat-sen in the revolution. So in 1 year alone, in 1905, 1 year, actually it's less than a year, 10,000 members in China, mostly youth, are being organized to join Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary movement. It's a good lesson for what we have to do here in the United States, and every single one of them, of course, has to be high quality. That's why we have this weekend. So from 1895 to 1911, there is 10 failures. There's one fight after the other, and they lose, but they keep on fighting to win the actual war and not so much just the battles. And in 1911, they succeed, led by Sun Yat-sen, to overthrow the Chinese emperor. And as Sun Yat-sen says himself, people asked him, how come that you are continuing? Because there was not really a sense of patriotism in China. And he said, key thing I struggled was to create such a patriotism and nationalism. And then I said, I always looked upon myself to provide leadership through my own acts, and then hoping when I inspired people that they would follow my lead. And therefore, of course, you cannot stop in the middle. You have to continue to fight and to become better and better. And he does literally everything. It's like when you have decided you are going for real to take leadership and to take responsibility for the nation and for the world, then it actually empowers you to become very strong and to get the ideas what is necessary to do, not just to be a follower or a good person, but actually to take real leadership. So he organizes the different military campaigns. He fundraises, as I said. He, let's give this and take the next one. Next one. Yeah. One of the things we have to look more into, so take this with a grain of salt, but I've already talked with some Chinese people about it, and it makes a lot of sense to me. This is military training of Chinese in Eagle Rock, California. And take the next one. This is also California Chinese soldiers being trained by a guy called O'Banion. And we're talking with some of the old Chinatown people, and we have to really hurry up because you have to talk with people that were family with people that lived at that time. But one thing that always wondered me was how it was really done militarily, because I know they trained with wooden weapons in Hawaii and you got the money, but how are you actually going to infiltrate and to lead people inside China? How are you going to go in and infiltrate the Manchu army in China and really lead battles that would lead to victory? And according to one study, Sun Yat-sen came more than the official times to the United States in order to train an army of officers in the United States from the different Chinatowns. And it started in Los Angeles. Yes? This is between 1890s, from the start, I think they're beginning to go into China and infiltrate into China in 1905 and on. According to what I have read so far, they train a total of 2,100 Chinese officers. They start in Los Angeles, where they set up under another excuse, a kind of an academy for Chinese people from Chinatown. And they get books and so forth, but it's all a screen for doing something else. So they have a fenced-in courtyard where they begin military training. And the money comes from people in Chinatown. And then they set up similar units in San Francisco, in New York, and so forth, where there are Chinese, where there's Chinatowns. And Sun Yat-sen comes and visits them. And at a certain point, the military police, or whatever the unit is called at that time, informs McKinley, so it already has started going on before McKinley was killed in 1901, that this is taking place, because if you have military training taking place on American soil, which is outside of American military, then at McKinley, and that's where we might be able to figure out how also to verify some of this, says that's okay, just what do you call it? Yeah, just, yeah. So don't just look the other way. So, for example, there's descriptions by how these Chinese officers, first, some of them are being smuggled into China to spy and infiltrate the Manchu army. They've been smuggled in different routes. And then they end up at 2,100, and they play a crucial role in the final years of the fight to provide actual military leadership as trained military officers inside China. So, at one of these travels, when Sun Yat-sen is in Germany, he meets up with a very important German politician called Rathenau. And Rathenau and leading young Russians, they have a study group, which is very important also for Sun Yat-sen's development. They have a study group where they study a Friedrich List, the German-American economist, Friedrich List's book on national economy. And Friedrich List was crucial in the industrialization of Germany and also for the United States. So Sun Yat-sen is so excited about getting these tools and to learn from Friedrich List. So he says, we must have this book translated into Chinese, ASAP. And I gave a speech once in Taiwan where I told this story, and an old man came up to me afterwards. He was in his 90s and said, look, it was my friend who did it on orders from Sun Yat-sen, that is translating Friedrich List's book on national economy into Chinese. And that's a fat book. I have it actually in Chinese. So anyway, I said he did everything. He also outlines in details how do you have a transitional period? You can just think for yourself if it's you. If you have had a country which for thousands of years has been an empire with hundreds of thousands of poor peasants, with colonial powers coming in, taking chunks, with Japan coming in from the north and so forth. So you have all these poor people, majority have no sense of a nation. So how are we going to have a transformation from that to a constitutional republic? So he goes through how the elections should be done, that not everybody should have, we should not just have free elections, but it should be done in stages, and how this should be done, how this should be preceded by education and economic development. And he also writes a constitution that has five legs instead of our three legs in detail, exactly how a constitution for the China should look like. And he has a he's very inspired by Lincoln, and he writes a famous book called I write in Chinese for a reason, and that is I like the name, and I like I hope you can more connect to America, where the connection is between Sun Yat-sen and Lincoln, one of the greatest statesmen America ever had. San Ming Ju Yi, the three principles of the people. Sun Yat-sen was so inspired by Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, by the people, of the people, and for the people, that he used that as a cornerstone in his teachings, teaching his soldiers and the people in China how China should be built up. So the three principles is the sovereign, the idea of the sovereign nation state, the sovereignty of the individual, and livelihood, the general welfare. And it's a quite an amazing book. It's a very big book. He goes through in very great detail where he travels around and organizes the country. This is after the emperor has been overthrown. And he has special people that will take notes of his speeches, and it is these notes from these speeches that are now in the San Ming Ju Yi, the three principles of the people. And he talks about, for example, concerning livelihood, concerning we need protective tariffs, how land ownership, how that should be shifted, how to everything in detail regarding how to order it so that the economy will function, learning very much from Friedrich List how to do it, and it's all around the general welfare in great detail. So next, this is another one of Sun Yat-sen's writings, Bo Ai, which means boy, you use for media, widespread, spread out. I love universal brotherhood. Is another one where he, not just for China, but for the world at large. And next. This is, remember I showed you earlier, Tian Xia Wei Gong. It's right there, Tian Xia Wei Gong. This whole thing, I'm not, it's a special writing. This is Sun Yat-sen's handwriting. But in all his conduct about learning from Lincoln and learning from Friedrich List, he always has Confucius with him. And this is a text from Confucius that Sun Yat-sen writes down regarding when you have a nation where the general welfare of the people is in the high seat, what kind of a nation you then have. You don't have to lock your door. People are not going to steal. People take care of it. They are rescuing the weak and lifting up the fallen. And that's the kind of where love is the guidance, where virtue is, how is it now? I forget now the saying. It's a special Confucius saying. Anyway, this is the Da Tong, of Confucius by Sun Yat-sen's handwriting. So he organized the whole revolution, then he creates the constitution, then he goes through in great detail regarding the sovereignty of the nation state and how to create livelihood for the Chinese people. He also, like LaRouche, which I thought was really fascinating, he has a book called Memoirs of a Chinese Revolutionary, where he goes again, where he details all that is bad about Chinese ideology. And if you think about how what I mentioned in the beginning, that what LaRouche has warned about, one of the big dangers is that if a culture or leaders of a culture don't look on the problematic side of a culture, because then you're going to fail. You have to look at what is weak and bad and change it. So that Sun Yat-sen does. So he has this whole book is just about the bad things in Chinese ideology. So he takes up how people want to be rich, how this go way back in Chinese ideology, and how bad that is. And actually, if you now it's Chinese New Year in a few days, and if you go to Chinatown and want to send something to people, a Chinese greeting, the only thing about is you wish your friends prosperity, money. There's nothing else but to get rich. And Sun Yat-sen said, go way back in Chinese history. You actually have to this day in the culture that if you have money, it doesn't matter how you got it, but somehow the ancestors like what you're doing. You're doing something good. If you are rich, you're good. So Sun Yat-sen attacks that. And what he really attacks in great detail is a Chinese saying and thinking saying, and it exists today in the axiom, the way it's functioning in Chinese thinking, that knowledge is easy and action is difficult. Knowledge is easy and action is difficult. And he goes through in great detail how what flaws that can lead to and how bad that is and how wrong that is. And he discusses the slave mentality of the Chinese. I actually once gave a class up in Vancouver to a group of Chinese people and about the Chinese ideology, thinking I could just do what LaRouche has been doing to us when we were younger. And the whole room walked out. It took like 5 minutes and everybody left the room. I never had anything like this happen before. And I thought it was completely innocent because it was Sun Yat-sen. But he was so right on the mark that they were completely upset and left the room, and I had to go out to get them in again and then figure out to do something else, because they were definitely not going to hear me talk about Sun Yat-sen and the ideology of the Chinese. So he also has a book called, which is also fascinating, called The Vital Problem of China, which you can get. And very sharp and insightful regarding the... Yes? The Vital Problem of China, and which is a book, it's not a big book, it's just a small book, where he goes through in detail warning about the oligarchy, and particularly the oligarchy's tool, namely the British. He has a very great insight how the British has played the world in Europe and in Asia. And he says, never be a friend of Britain. And what the British do, he said, what they do is they do like a silkworm farmer. Like a silkworm farmer making sure the silkworms have all the kind of temperatures and nutrition and so forth they want, and they take the silk out, and they take the silk out, and they stroke them, and they take the silk out, and so forth. And when they don't produce silk anymore, the British are doing like the silkworm farmer are doing. You are either getting burned or drowned. That's the words, and that's the image he uses regarding the British. And how much impact this book had was interesting, because I read a book and then I started talking with Chinese friends about this book, and they didn't know it. And it didn't matter whether they came from mainland China and Taiwan, nobody knew this book. And then I looked up and had Chinese friends looking up in the collected works of Sun Yat-sen, and it wouldn't be there. So then we decided, therefore, to... we went to Columbia University, where a Chinese friend of mine, we had a mimeograph, and he would typeset the Chinese from the mimeograph, and then Chiang Kai-shek's second son and Helga both wrote a preface to the book, and then the Schiller Institute published the book. And the last time it was published was in 1947. So I come to meet Jiang Weiguo, who is Chiang Kai-shek's son, who has written one of the prefaces to the book, and he's not there yet. But some of his generals around him was there. And they when I came with the book, I was really excited. We had gotten out Sonia Tsen's book in Chinese. And they looked at me like this, and they said, "This book should never have been published." And I said, "Well, this is..." And we were all sitting down. I said, "Well, this is Sonia Tsen. This is the father of China. And so forth. It should never have been published." And at that point, I stood up, and they all stood up too, but they kind of were small, right? So it was kind of... And at that point, yeah, and I was a woman, and they were all men, right? Generals, so it's kind of funny. They were all connected to the London Institute for Strategic Studies. And so when Zhang Weiguo came to the meeting, he immediately saw the situation. And he came over to me with big arms and gave me a big hug and said, "I'm so happy to see you, Leni. And how is Linda LaRouche doing?" And then he ordered the same day. He had a banquet the same night. And he ordered 100 books from me, which I got to him for that banquet. And it was really nice red books with Sonia Tsen's picture on, right? And then on each plate for that banquet was Sonia Tsen's book. That was his personal intervention. So, but you can imagine with these reactions, keeping it out of publication with these reactions, that this really struck a raw nerve with the British, and they wanted that out of circulation, and they have succeeded until we caught the sniff of it. So by the end of the Versailles, by the end of the First World War, there's a really nasty treaty, the Versailles Treaty, which was very harsh for the losers. And you don't do that when you after a war, you make sure that the people that have lost the war, they can build up their nations again and to create a basis for peace. And this is a real nasty treaty. And Sonia Tsen realized that, and he said, "This is the basis for a new world war. This treaty makes the basis for a second world war, and I'm now issuing an alternative policy proposal." And he called it that, an alternative policy proposal to secure peace. This was his peace through development proposal, and he called that the international development of China. Next. And that's also not very clear. It's much more clear on an old-fashioned overhead, these maps. This is true. Anyway, I don't know what Marty, what's wrong with these computers. So the international development of China, check the next one, see how good that is. Oh, this is better. This is our Eurasian language proposal. It's Sonia Tsen writes the international development of China, which is very, very much like our Eurasian language proposal that we came out with in 1997, which calls for building of development corridors spanning from Asia to Europe through Africa and later on through the entire world with fast speed rail, with 100 kilometers of development around the rails, building of thousands of new beautiful Renaissance cities and literally making the land alive through creating blood veins for transportation of people, of goods, developing the areas around it. You can really see it like you're creating life in that way. And that's what he did. If you read, you can get it. If you read the international development of China, it's in our library in Los Angeles, but you should check it out so that other people can read the book too and not just take it and read it. But it's in the library. And he goes through from the very beginning how this is an alternative to the Versailles Treaty. And he goes through the routes from China into Africa and to Europe in great detail. He also, and he says this is the basis for peace, is collaboration among the different nations for mutual development. And for China, he makes a detailed development program for China, from the Three Gorges Dam that is almost finished now, to all the different ports that should be built, to reforestation, everything, very detailed. And as a peace program, very much like the initiatives we are doing today. And he calls for directly. He says we have to have an integration of Europe and China and develop the whole land area. Next. So, Sun Yat-sen, can I have some light? Good. Let me see here. Yeah, I said, but I want to repeat it again. He sends it all over the world, and he writes in English because he wants to mobilize world leaders to have this program to prevent a Second World War. And immediately after the war, friends of the foreign minister from Germany, Rathenau, they go to China for intensive discussions on Sun Yat-sen's program. And this is a connection you have called the Rapallo efforts between Russia and Germany and China, but that is all being destabilized. Rathenau is assassinated. You have warlords in China being paid by Hong Kong Shanghai Bank to mobilize against Sun Yat-sen inside China. He dies in 1925, I believe. And the Chinese built this memorial for him near Nanjing, the southern capital of China. Next. And that's the memorial. There is a big survival now, not survival, revival of Sun Yat-sen in China today, as well also of that of Confucius. So the question is, I use this time to go through a few of the key ideas of Confucius, and to give some of a gestalt image of what Sun Yat-sen was for a character. He was a real revolutionary leader, and he was a leader in all aspects. He carried all through, he went all through with whatever was necessary to do. And it's kind of the kind of leader that LaRouche is asking for people to step up and become today. So we had these ideas of Confucius, which are really beautiful. And a person like Sun Yat-sen, many centuries later, acting on them. So how come that LaRouche can say that that China, for example, lacks an understanding of the principles that are necessary for a modern sovereign nation state? How does that hang together? And one of the things actually is already answered in the beginning of what I said, namely that China, through several centuries, has been raped by colonization from outside, and that the people that came to China, the same is true for India and Vietnam and so forth, where the people that came from outside to colonize was the very bastards that the Renaissance people fought in Europe. So they only saw the worst sides, apart from even the missionaries. There was very, very few missionaries in Asia that were not pawns, either by being cowards or by money and so forth. Some of you have heard me give a presentation on this great missionary, Father Lebbe, but he was one out of hundreds of missionaries, and he was the only one with courage and guided by love and carrying that out. So they never saw anything that would get them to know the most beautiful, essential things with European culture. You have, then think about the empire through several thousand years, and what I discussed also, that no real sense of a country. This is one thing that when Sun Yat-sen began the fight, one of the key things, how are we going to get people to think about China and fight for China? It's very difficult. People didn't have a sense of a nation. And then if you look at the 19th century, before Sun Yat-sen gets on the scene, you had the Opium Wars, where England forced a war upon China to be allowed to export opium into China. When China didn't want to have opium imposed upon them, England declared war so that they would have the opium in the name of free trade. Free trade? We have to travel in slaves, and we have to travel in opium. We can travel in wherever we want to, and if you don't want it, war. Same kind of thinking concerning you have now with war. Really nasty. Huh? So you had the colonization that I mentioned before, you had after, can we have the next one, see what the next function, after the, yeah, probably, very difficult, it's not clear at all. Well, this is China, and you can see it's all scratched from one end to the other, and this is China, and it's all, except for a couple of places, it's all controlled and influenced by foreign powers. This is the various warlords. Yeah, the various warlords controlled by the outside forces. Let me go a step back. I said that Hong Kong Shanghai Bank was funding the warlords in China to go after Sun Yat-sen and destroy what he was trying to do. And this is all them. I for a moment thought that the map I thought I had concerning colonial powers had been put in there. But that's the different warlords. Finance from outside. Then after Sun Yat-sen died, you had a civil war beginning between, which was also orchestrated from outside, between a communist north and the so-called Kuomintang, the nationalist party in the south. The idea was to split up China in at least two parts, because if you split up China, you can control it. To this day, there are puppets controlled from London. You have Gerald Siegel of the London Institute for Strategic Studies. He wrote an article in 1994 how it would be great to split China up. It's island seven. I think he calls for seven parts. And in Foreign Affairs, if you look the article up, there it is, right there. And you have key people in Japan that are puppets for England who are publicly arguing for China to be split up in anything from seven parts to 11 parts. So, because if you can do that, then you can control it. And so after Sun Yat-sen, you had this with the communists in the north and the Kuomintang in the south, controlled from London. The whole fight controlled from London. And then you had in 1934, you had in the middle of all that, you have the Japanese invading horrendously, going way down in southern part of China, creating havoc on their way. So the communist wins, and Mao becomes leader. And Mao had one campaign after the other. That's kind of how he organized things. So when he first came to power in the 50s, he had the first campaign called Let the Hundred Flower Grow. Hundred Flowers Grow, or Let the Hundred Flowers Bloom. And what was in that is that let all the intellectuals and people with great ideas, let them now speak up, let them bloom, so that we can figure out what is the best for China, so that this will help China. So intellectuals from all across the country stood up, they gave speeches, they wrote articles and so forth, and then Mao had found all the ones that could be his potential adversaries, and they were executed, jailed or executed. So that was Let the Hundred Flowers Bloom. Then in 1961, you had something, a new campaign that Mao called the Great Leap Forward. And the Great Leap Forward was a gigantic leap into the grave for millions and millions of people. What the Great Leap Forward was, that Mao said that now China should make a jump into a modern industrialized nation, and therefore all the villages should produce steel. So he called for people to bring their agricultural tools, their pots and pans, everything that was made by steel. Then we make a fire in the village, and we melt the steel, and we will make a great leap forward. Man. That meant that the people that had been used to till the earth and had been taught how to do it, they left the land. It was left to people that had no idea what to do, plus a lot of the tools and so forth was gone into the to be melted. And that meant in a very short period that millions and millions and millions died of starvation. just in the province next to Shanghai called Anhui Province, 30 million people died of hunger in 1 year alone. There's these grotesque stories about how people couldn't be buried because people just died in the ditches and so forth, and there was nobody with energy and so forth to bury them. 30 million in one province alone. So that was the great leap forward. Then the next major campaign was the Cultural Revolution, which started in 1966 and went on for 10 years. And you had people that would, you had people that simply everything that you had that was concerning, connected to intellectual life was declared bourgeois. So people that had been university professors, music teachers, and so forth, was either jailed, executed, or sent to the countryside to learn by the people, to learn from the people. And as I said, that took place for 10 years. You had professors, they would be taken out and ridiculed, put out for public ridicule with things, with posters on their bodies and so forth. Slogans would be blaring out from loudspeakers in all the cities. And for 10 years, there was no real education taking place. Everything from the West was regarded counter-revolutionary. And I have now three short clips. I'll recommend you see the whole movie. I have three short clips from the movie with Isaac Stern in China from 1979. He asks a question, and just want to, he asks a question at one point. He tours together with a pianist, he tours China for 3 weeks. And they listen to a lot of young people that are 19, 20 years old. They listen to young kids that are 6 or 7 years old and play instruments, violin, piano, and so forth. And they say after a while, they say, how come that the older guys, the 19 and 20 year olds, they are very proficient in technique and so forth, but there's no ideas. They're kind of cold. They're just good at playing the notes. There's a big gap between them and the 6 and 7 year olds. How come? And you will get the answer in this little clip, one of the little clips we're going to play here. Get the song. I think I'll start a counter-revolution against computers very soon. Okay, forget about it then.
Make it work.
An old-fashioned video machine. Not in that way. This is like 3 hours work to get three little clips of 9 minutes from Marty and others. Okay. All right. Well, skip it. It's very beautiful. I suggest you get the video. Oh, I have a DVD that functioned when we didn't have to clip it. And it's a very moving film, because what basically an old man is saying, who is a violin teacher, he used to teach how Beethoven, Mozart and so forth, Western great composers. And I want us to skip it, really. With the Cultural Revolution, he not only lost his job, he was put in a closet. And everything, 11 of his colleagues that he had worked with committed suicide. And he had taught also how to build violins and so forth. And he says the reason that the young children in China were so moving and beautiful and really express ideas with what they were doing, their music, was that they didn't go through the Cultural Revolution. But then you have this gap from the 7, 8-year-olds to the 18, 19-year-olds that for 10 years they could not play. I want to go back to the slides now. They could not play Beethoven and Mozart and so forth, and they have only revolutionary Mao songs, and therefore there was a gap of 10 years where they didn't develop. So, can I have some light, please, just for a second? Can I have some light, please? Now this is completely being arrived again, classical music from the West and so on. And when you talk with Chinese people, one thing I used to do a lot, I'll take up what LaRouche says, the importance of seeing that the difference between man and the animal. And if you do this to a Chinese person, they'll be really upset with you. I've had it happen to me several times. They'll think that you treat them as if they're stupid. Of course man is different from the animal. I mean, how can you treat me like, it's almost like you are snobbish saying that to them. And the Chinese have, for example, words that will signify how much they know that animal is different from man. Like hair on a person has a different name than hair on an animal. And all kinds of different things. Things connected with the animal world is very different from things connected with people world. So, but what you have, I can give you some ideas, like to this day, it is regarded totally fine to have public executions for people to look at. You have children of criminals in China are regarded as outcasts. Nobody really wants to deal with them because there's something wrong with them since their parents are in jail. One thing that really was a whammer for me regarding trying to begin to understand this, because this is what LaRouche, the reason LaRouche has written these papers now in this period for what we have to do is when you deal with different cultures. I had it a lot when I came to U.S., although my English was good. I would say something, it took me a couple of years to figure it out, and I would be hurt, I would feel misunderstood, and so forth, because the ideas are not in the words. And then if you talk with people that where it's even further removed concerning difference of cultures, you can literally sit and talk with a person from India or from China or from Myanmar, and it's like you understand each other perfectly concerning the words. But then when you make some questions to kind of figure out if they get it, if we're on the same wavelength, you realize you've been talking like this. And that's one of the things that LaRouche is addressing. So one of the ways I learned a lot, just a little thing, so it was a couple of years ago in Taiwan, where people had formed something called the Open Heart Society. And this was parents who had children had been born with heart diseases, so they needed to have a surgery when they were little, when they were babies and so forth. And therefore, in order to support each other, you would have a society, the Open Heart Society, signifying the heart surgery, and you would help each other. So, and then you had these modern, well-to-do, in Taiwan, very developed, people, these parents saying, of course we need to support each other, because everybody knows if you have given birth to a deformed child, to a child that is not, there's something wrong with it, you have done something wrong and you're being punished by the ancestors. This is in the newspapers, in the television and so forth, as if, of course you know that, then there's something is wrong with you. So, and then you have what I mentioned before, also regarding a different way of you looking at man to be rich. In addition, like Taiwan again, that is very developed, the women are like, if you are married, you've been married for whatever long it is, if you get a divorce, the man gets everything, house, children, whatever, and he doesn't have to pay you a dime. To this day, there's some people trying to change it, but to this day. So the view that that man is something special, participating in the creation process, the ideas that Confucius represented never became a part of Chinese culture. And with all the disturbances from outside, what I talked about, colonizations, invasions from Japan and whatnot, what Sun Yat-sen represented never was transformed into a living culture. Like LaRouche points out in one of these articles, he points out it's very important for Asians to understand that Solon was not enough for Europe to as a basis for creating a modern sovereign nation state. That you had to have a number of developments like Dante Alighieri, Joan of Arc, Council of Florence, and so forth to actually make that possible. So that becomes part of the national culture, which is not the case today. So LaRouche says one of the key things, and this is very much up to us, and I think very much up to the youth movement, is that what is necessary for Asian cultures to get is to be provided with the innermost principles or the most crucial best features of what European civilization represents. And that is what the youth are working to in all areas to recreate through recreating a new renaissance. And that is what needs to be communicated and to be thought about in order to be communicated to Asia, to Africa, and so forth. I mean, you can just think about the problems today we have to communicate the best principles of the United States abroad, because people look at America just as a big evil bully. And don't think about the founding fathers of Lincoln, of FDR, and so forth. It goes much deeper for the best in European cultures as such. And that's what LaRouche has called for. And get such a treasure, to get everybody to have such a treasure of the very most beautiful people from the past, and to have an in-depth knowledge about it, so that this is where you stand to give to your own nations. You have a knowledge of what the best people in the history did before you, whether they were Asians or Europeans, and with that in your mind, when you do that, then they become immortal. You carry their ideas forward on a higher level, and that's what is necessary for in order for Asians to get an in-depth knowledge. And they are very much what we are doing today in this fight, concrete fight in the United States, is crucial, and what we're doing concerning the LaRouche University on Wheels. And I wanted to, regarding people from the past, I wanted to show some souls, just a few examples of some souls from China's past. Yes. Turn on the light, please. Oh my, now I cannot see my notes at all. This is fishermen on a snowy day. This is 700 AD. It's one of my favorite paintings, Chinese paintings. It probably doesn't come across very much in the back. It's not very clear. If you see it for real, or you have a normal overhead or a slide, you will have, the eyes are like really staring out at you. Here you have this guy who's somewhat sterilized, the way the Chinese sometimes do it in paintings with the clothing and so forth. But the soul, if it's clear rendition, you can see this guy's soul through what is coming out of his eyes. but I don't expect you to be able to do this with this rendition. This is based on a poem, which I cannot read the translation of, so I'll just show you to you in it's basically an old man who's out on a snowy winter day, and he has no children. He's all alone. And next, this is the poem. Next. This is a night outing with candles. This is also a poem where it basically goes that the flowers are so beautiful. This is from the Song Dynasty from the 12th century. The flowers, these flowers here that are kind of floating, they're so beautiful, so I light the candles, these, so I can stay up all night because I'm scared if I go to sleep they will fall off the trees. So I want to enjoy them as much as possible. Next. This is also from the Song Dynasty. There they put the poem on the painting. Can I just have the light for 1 second? This is mountains hold the autumn colors near. Swallows cross the evening sun slowly. And turn off the light, please. I'm just going to give you, the swallows are down here. And I'm not going to give you a presentation on Chinese paintings now. I just wanted to give you a few, just a little sniff of an extraordinary beauty from China's past. And also done in ways that is different from how you communicate ideas in the West. Next. I put this up. This is from the painting. Because also, just the way the Chinese classical poetry is functioning is you have even sounds and inflected sounds. And so not only the painting with the whole composition, but also the poem has to be in a very odd and a very specific way musically. So if you see the first line, San Han Chou Shi Jin, Yan Du Shi Yang Shi. And so you see San on the top line, that is an even tone. The second line, Yan, is an inflected tone. You cannot have, if you have two lines of poetry, you have to have the opposite in the second line. And you have all kinds of other rules. So in this little painting, can we go back? In this little painting, there's all kind of language being communicated that it takes a little time to fully appreciate. But you can, even if you don't know anything about China, there's a certain inherent message in there of beauty that you know there's something special there. Next. And this is also one of my favorites. This is also, you cannot see that well. Again, if you could see these eyes, it's sterilized clothing, because the Chinese don't think that in painting the clothing are that important. What is important is the soul. When you have a portrait, the hat and the dress is like a frame of a painting, not important. The important thing is the face. In particular, the eyes is the most important thing, and then the mouth. And this is an old 80-year-old man, a very famous Chinese painter. And he wrote the inscriptions on top himself. Light, please. And where is it now? Now I can't find anything. He writes... come on, Lini. This has been such a struggle. I can't find it. See, normally I have everything written out. Here we are. Ordered and so forth. He writes up on this self-portrait. He writes, "Some consider my eyes too small. Others find my jaw too narrow. I wouldn't know. How can I know what might be lacking? What is the point of comparing eyes and face? My only fear is that virtue be lost. So negligent these sub 80 years. And now death is barely a step away. So this is this old man's self-portrait. And I wanted to show a couple of these paintings and poems to kind of give you an idea that of beautiful Chinese people and make them alive again, they make them immortal through giving them to you of the people living in China's past. And now, as to conclude, LaRouche comes up with a brilliant proposal for how are we going to on the highest level have a guiding line for a concept of nations collaborating with each other. And he says that the key thing he thinks we should be using is Vernadsky, the Russian scientist's idea about the noosphere, because he said Vernadsky's idea about the noosphere, this is the science that would be appropriate for a concept of nations, and where what is being put to each nation to do is to have a policy nationally and a collaboration with each other where the individual is defining and deciding the future for all of mankind. And I would like Danny to read a favorite passage from Vernadsky. Have in your mind when he reads it that what I just said regarding how LaRouche thinks that this direction is the very best center for collaboration in the future.
We are living in a brand new, bright geological epoch. Man, through his labor and his conscious relationship to life, is transforming the envelope of the Earth, the geological region of life, the biosphere. Man is shifting it into a new geological state through his labor and his consciousness. The biosphere is in a process of transition to the noosphere. Man is creating new biogeochemical processes which never existed before. The biogeochemical history of the chemical elements, a planetary phenomenon, is drastically changing. Enormous masses of new free metals and their alloys are being created on Earth. For example, ones which never existed here before, such as aluminum, magnesium, and calcium. Plant and animal life are being changed and disturbed in the most drastic manner. New species and races are being created. The face of the Earth is changing profoundly. The stage of the noosphere is being created. Within the Earth's biosphere, an intense blossoming is in process, the further history of which will be grandiose, it seems to us. In this geological process, which is fundamentally biogeochemical, a single individual unit of living matter out of the totality of humanity, a great personality, whether a scientist, an inventor, or a statesman, can be of fundamental, decisive, directing importance and can manifest himself as a geological force. This sort of manifestation of individuality in processes of enormous biogeochemical importance is a new planetary phenomenon. It emerged and began to manifest itself ever more sharply and profoundly in the course of time during the most recent tens of thousands of years, on the background of billions of years of the prior history of the biosphere when this phenomenon did not exist.
So LaRouche says that it is the efficient transfer of this knowledge on this level that is going to be key and in the personal identity of the human individual. And I would like to show the next one. This is the map of the population density in the world. So that is that is the reason why the key area for a tremendous jump, first for securing peace, but in connection with that development, is here in the area from Asia to Europe. If you think about if it's being allowed that the power and creativity of the individual to be educated, that the policies of the nations are going to be directed according to what Danny just read up regarding Vernadsky and the enlargement creation of the noosphere. If you have the policies, the economic policies, scientific policies, and education policies being directed with that idea, then you can see the incredible power that will be unleashed and can be unleashed in the future with all the people, where you have the most people in Asia and you're the biggest population density. So you're looking at a potential tremendous power regarding the noosphere as expressed in this population density map. If the policies that are being carried out is with the idea of the human nature that man is good and let's unleash the maximum power of the individual human being on Earth here in the future, and that's what LaRouche is all about to do, and that's what his intention is. So I will end with that. Any questions? Yeah.
Having a dialogue of nations with this idea of having an idea of monotheism actually being brought there. But also in his intervention at Berlin, he stated, well, we want a dialogue of civilizations, a dialogue of cultures. We do not want a dialogue of religions. It was just definitely something that was occurring, I guess. And I was kind of curious if you could expound on it a little bit.
With all this, that's why I think it's great to discuss, because and people should say if they have other thing they think about it, but Lynn said, I read up earlier, Lynn says that it's only such an idea that will function, the only premise. And it's also the only premise that where Asian nations can trust us. If you kind of lift it up, which I think is what Vernadsky is, what Lynn is doing through using Vernadsky, where that is just in different words to look upon it as man as being participating in the creation process. So if you use that as the science from where you collaborate, then it gets out of. And if you have, at the same time, you don't have to be Christian, for example, on the highest principles of what CUSA represented or represents today, and with the Council of Florence, with man participating in the creation process, that there is a substantiality between the Creator, the Holy Spirit, and man. It can just be like as an idea, an important idea, which if you lift it, what I found was so brilliant with what LaRouche did with Vernadsky is that it just takes it way up there, and the way Vernadsky looks at it is in a monotheistic way. And it's for everybody, little children, if they know the words. To everybody else can see, wow, that's a complete different way of looking at it. And if I really develop my powers, I can participate in the way that Confucius say, in transforming and nourishing everything between heaven and earth, right? So I think if we take it instead of just consensus and so forth, I think it's really brilliant with Vernadsky. I think it'll be, yes. See, but the problem you really have is that, let me put it in a different way. No. But let me put it in a different way. You have, like, for example, why do you have this tremendous, beautiful painting culture. But it never became part of, which was seeping into the general population, so it became part of the way the nation ticked, so to speak. Where every time you had a new emperor in China, depending how they were, but they would always surround themselves with different architects, painters, other scholars, and so forth. And then when a new emperor would come on board, they would all flee or be put in jail or whatever, because you could not, as a new emperor, trust the people you had surrounded yourself before, another emperor surrounded himself with. So therefore, you had to leave. Like at a certain point, this is part of the Southern Song Renaissance being created, where all of the artists and scholars had fled to the south, away from Beijing. And then at one point, you had like over 100 great people just in a little enclave down at the Yangtze River, because they couldn't be in Beijing anymore because there had come a new emperor. But and you had good periods, but this, that the major part of the country was always poor, and it was never the policy of the nation to change that. Let's take a total other example, like a guy like Lincoln, which it took me quite some years to figure out coming to America, where if you convince Americans they should do something and they find out it's right, you can get Americans to drive 5 hours, 6 hours to come to a meeting. You can get Americans to give proportionally everything or much more proportional to what a European would ever do. You have this that, or also just physically would do to drive to a meeting and so forth. Europeans wouldn't do that. Or you have in Europe, you don't have a word for to lobby, because lobby. L-O-B-B-Y, where in, if you want to have a meeting with a parliamentarian, you have to write a letter and go through the secretaries and what up, and all the doors are closed. I mean, if you go to a parliament, the doors are closed. You cannot go in just to have a meeting. You can just kind of step in and talk with an aide. It doesn't exist. So you get to have a sense when you've been in America a little bit longer that there's a certain things, what LaRouche has called the Lincoln reflex, that Americans have a sense that I can actually fight, and if I fight, I'll create a change, because that happened before in the United States, this crucial fight with the Civil War. So that became, as LaRouche says concerning Asia, we had the same thing in Europe, that these things became part of the culture, often through great crises. And then great leaders standing up. He mentioned Gandhi. If that has succeeded, or let's say that the British had not succeeded in all doing all the counter regarding China, let's say that certain of the key things with that Sun Yat-sen represented had actually been allowed to be fought through and won. Huh? But that never happened. So it never became part of... China is even more stiff in that sense, what I just said concerning doing something, than Europe, for example. Yes? I have not forgotten you, sorry. But Eddie first, okay, sorry.
Oh, you mentioned how, like, Sun Yat-sen was the key organizer of the Chinese Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that he had the four rebels?
Yeah.
Were the four rebels around him? Yeah. I was thinking, what was like, the difference between the way he organized the revolution and how the American Revolution was organized? Did he have, like, you know, scientists that collaborated with him? Did he have, like, you know, fighting battles like Leibniz with Newton and these kinds of things?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, also the problem you have is he was always on the road. So, I mean, to my knowledge, most of, if not all, but the big majority of everything you see being Sun Yat-sen's writings is not his writings, it's his speeches that was written down when he was on the road. And if you look at China, again, if you have to kind of think back for centuries, well, you had, in the way, you had Radenau, you had leading scientists from Russia that he collaborated around with concerning Friedrich List, you had that, right? I mean, if he hadn't had the support and collaboration in that way, or it wouldn't have functioned. But inside China, you had some of the guy, I forget his name now, that set up one newspaper after the other. But China was really destroyed with all these things, from the emperor to the colonialists to the Japan. It was horrendous. Horrendous struggle that they were going through for many, many, many years. So who he would have in China, you know. Also, one of the problems you have with it is a lot of it is the same thing with his training of the military officers in the United States, that also concerning key collaborators in China, that things were extremely secret in order to succeed. So, but it's good for research. I mean, let's do some more. We need to do much more research in different key periods in China's history and also recently. Yes?
I was just wondering if Christianity is still banned there, freedom of religion.
I didn't understand you.
Well, there was a time when Christian missionaries had to go, like, undercover over there. So I was wondering if it's still that way, or if it can be an open thing for them to have churches.
Well, I would say concerning missionaries who go undercover, they were really for the big minority, for the big majority of them, were really at the very best cowards. Most of them sold out and were not Christians at all. You had a situation on Sun Yat-sen's time when he was organizing for overthrowing the emperor, like 1900. You had, right after the Boxer Rebellion, was that the missionaries, for example, in Beijing, they didn't speak Chinese, the majority of them. They would eat with a knife and fork and eat European food. The Chinese could not become bishops because they were lower rank. So only if you were European could you become a bishop. The Chinese priests couldn't sit with the tables with the European priests because the Chinese priests were lower. What we had, for example, was you would have, they were used by the, it was not so much the missionaries, it was just they were lower class and they were used by the colonial powers. So you had a number of cases, you can look it up, where you had a missionary from France being killed. And they would use that as an excuse for going in and taking a chunk, send in the French army and take a chunk of China because of one missionary being killed. Not very Christians. Concerning today, and that I think that's very connected with what LaRouche says concerning a dialogue of culture and what we talked about and so forth, because they never experienced, except for a few individuals, of course, right? But as a general in the nation, they never experienced that the church should be something very good. Because when the church is like that, that's a racist church. That's a church also that somebody is lower than others, and so on. So you would never get a good idea about the church from the missionaries going into China. That's what I mentioned earlier, like all the things they've had for centuries and also the last 40 years was the worst view of man that was imposed from outside. So today, I know there's been a number of efforts between the current Pope and the Chinese government with the different leaders to have a rapprochement, but it's still so today that if you are a Catholic in China, you cannot adhere to the Pope. You have to be registered and be a part of a church in China. You cannot be under Rome.
So what are the churches? Do they have freedom of religion to pick any religion they want?
I really don't think that's I don't think that's the way to go at it. Because, but the reason is it comes from a different premise. Like, for example, the present China is very controlled, right? And the Chinese, the majority of the Chinese that can read, they know that the press is very controlled. So therefore, they read between the lines and they try to get the news in different ways and so forth. In America, people believe that the press is free. That everything that is in the newspapers and in the television and so forth, when it's on the news and so forth, it's free. So therefore, it's the truth. And people, it's a much bigger danger. No, I mean it very seriously. It's a much bigger danger because when you think something is free and it's extremely controlled, you are a slave. If you know something is controlled and you're not given whatever, then you are not being so controlled in the same way. For example, they have had a lot of Asia in different countries. The United States again and again has threatened with 301 sanctions to open up everything, to open up advertisements, to open up whatever, so foreign products to come in and so on. And if China, mainland China, Taiwan, Malaysia and so forth didn't want to do it, U.S. has been threatened with 301 sanctions. And I have seen the changes going over there after, for example, in Taiwan, they gave in to the pressures concerning, for example, Malaysia. I was told, I don't know, but I was told by people that have been working with Malaysia that Malaysia didn't want all these movies that can now be taken down from the satellites. So they have made a special jammer system so that the movies they don't want the Malaysian people to see, they can jam up. I don't know how it's functioning. I know the Chinese don't want the Chinese people to have all the different movies coming from the West. And then you say, well, that's not free. Shouldn't people be free to watch everything they want to watch? Well, it's kind of interesting because when I got this argument, I asked people, well, can you mention 10 movies for me that has come out the last 10 years that you think will be good for people to see? And they couldn't really mention any. That would be good for the development of the general population. So that's also a little bit of the, that is the rape that LaRouche is talking about regarding the so-called modern culture, which is a degradation of man and just going for bodily lusts, violence and bodily lusts. Okay, we can do that in a second. We have the video now. He's going to prove something good about computers. Anyway, we can take, if there's other questions, so we can take that in the end, yes? No, not assassinated, that went against him in his efforts to unite China.
Oh.
Rather now that he had collaborated with in Germany was assassinated.
Okay.
But see, this is like, okay, let me, don't worry about the particulars, but this is happening all the time. So you had, in order for the oligarchy and the British, the financier, Anglo-Dutch faction, to make sure that Sun Yat-sen would not succeed. It would be like another America, to create another America with incredible potential, if you think about it. Huh? So in order for that not to succeed, they used money through a really scumbag bank that is a real drug bank, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, to this day is a no-good bank, okay? To give money, bribe, like you are bribing people today, to go with Social Security, to bribe the warlords to go against Sun Yat-sen. Huh? So that's what was the deal. Outside manipulation. To make sure, like it has been outside manipulation, like the British supported the Confederate South. They supported the slavery in the Confederate South to make sure, to make sure that Lincoln wouldn't succeed. Same thing. Yes?
I was just wondering how.
Oh.
Is that pressure still there, and how are you organizing like leaders there to organize the population? Like how does it work when you're trying to build a dialogue of nations if the population is really not
well? It will have to be through a number of crucial leaders, and that's why LaRouche wrote these two articles, because one thing that is really important to understand, and I hope I can be clear enough, actually, in a very direct sense, it's not going to happen. I'm a little bit facetious now, but not really, because in a very direct way, it is not going to happen through Chinese people or Indian people or so forth, Korean people. It's going to happen through Lyndon LaRouche. the reason I'm saying that is that LaRouche in Arab nations, African nations, and Asian nations is extremely respected. Therefore, they know that he's a man standing up for principle. He has shown it through, he has owned his colors, so to speak. And therefore, when LaRouche comes out with extremely provocative ideas and telling leaders in the world what needs to be done in order for us to succeed, when he says that China is going to be destroyed if we don't win the situation in the United States, the rest of the world will go to hell, including China and India and Russia and so forth. There's no place where people can kind of just hide out and somehow make it. So when he says that, and he's an elder statesman, and he's been followed for many years by leaders, and they begin to get a whiff of it, which people are getting now, that is, a number of leading Chinese people know that China is on the chopping block in the future. That is not primarily about Iraq, Iran, Syria, and so forth. No, China is one of the real targets. So what LaRouche is doing now is conducting a number of seminars with leading people. That was the one we talked about in Berlin. And others are going to come. And individual meetings are taking place with LaRouche in these weeks and months. What he's saying is being followed extremely closely now because of the crisis. And because U.S. government today is so ugly. And here he's standing out as the real American. So that's how it's going to function. That key people rise to the occasion and actually take the curriculum that LaRouche has outlined in these two. This is like a curriculum for a state's leaders who love your nation. If you're Chinese and love China, same in India, Korea, and so forth, you take these two papers and you follow LaRouche's advice and you begin to learn about the most beautiful features in the West and why this strength came from, and learn to begin to figure out to divide up between in the struggle in the West. And this is this beautiful papers in the way that it speaks with such a respect for the reader to grow up and become a statesman and a stateswoman. Yes?
Is Confucius a Buddhist? And I was wondering, where does he go to school, and who is he
I don't have the faintest ideas. He's not a Buddhist. He's Confucius. Actually, they have a whole religion of Confucianism, okay? Actually, the whole thing you had earlier was that one of the things that was also manipulated from outside was that if you were having, which is what Leibniz intervenes into, because there was a certain faction of the church at one point, the Catholic Church, who said if you wanted to become a Christian and convert to Christianity, you could not respect and pay respect to Confucius at the same time. And so the Pope at that time, I forget which Pope it was, sent out a bull, that if a papal bull, that if you wanted to be a Christian, you could not respect and pay respect to Confucius. So that created a big uproar in China at that time. Where Leibniz goes through this book, which is a beautiful little book called On the Natural Theology of the Chinese, where he goes through what he thinks as a Christian and what Confucius thinks. And again he said, well, they think like me. So they cannot pay respect to Confucius and become a Christian at the same time. So, yes?
And the LaRouche say for the man made in God's image. No, I didn't say the title right, but it goes.
What is God that man is in his image?
There's a part where like the Pope actually is like challenging the idea of Nirvana and Buddhism, and like a bunch of a certain section of Buddhists got incredibly upset with this book that the Pope had written. So that's like the initial fight of the beginning of it, right? And so. It seems like that is like a I don't know if all Buddhists believe this way or what.
Well, I can tell you that I had LaRouche's little article about what is God, that man is in his image. I had it translated into Chinese. I have a lot of very good Buddhist friends. And we had, LaRouche has some great Buddhist supporters. I mean, it's like, it doesn't really, that's why LaRouche says this thing with the religions. I mean, you can call yourself a Christian like Ashcroft and be a Satanist, right? And so people call themselves all kinds of things. I mean, so I know Buddhists that are real assholes. And then know Buddhists that are really striving to do good for mankind, where we then need to put them up at a level and using LaRouche's writings and the whole idea that Lynn has about Vernadsky. But Lynn wrote this article, and my Buddhist friends I had, they loved this article. They were not offended by LaRouche's article at all, because LaRouche took that up because the Pope had taken it up, right? So LaRouche, in order to intervene in that and actually not to get any more schism between Buddhist countries and Rome, made this intervention. And it was taken also because of how people listened to LaRouche, was taken very, very well. I mean, I have friends that I didn't know about who are Buddhist friends who took this article and sent it around to people, and it was discussed a lot, LaRouche's paper. I'm not an expert. What LaRouche has taken up was that, and again, see, there's some Buddhists that the only thing, in particular the little wheel Buddhists, that are only thinking about themselves to become a Buddha. That is, if you are not doing good things on earth, to put it very simple, you can kind of be less than a person. You can become a dog or something else. And then if you are really good, but you have all these rules, then you can become a Buddha. But it's very self-centered. And LaRouche at one point said that the small wheel Buddhist is not a strong culture for survival. It's very weak. But I don't think that's really so relevant to discuss, particularly because LaRouche said, let us lift it up above religions. He very, very specifically stated that in his paper, that this is not a religious issue. It's an issue about the nature of man and principles of the highest order, and which path are we going to go in order to succeed. And so, all right, yes?
You have some the propaganda around free Tibet and the cultural historical warfare between China and Tibet.
Well, it used to be so that the Tibetans, they allied with the Mongols and occupied China. And at least since then, they have been part of China. I'm just kind of being funny. And you also have today places that have autonomy, that are part of China but has autonomy rule. So that has been like that for centuries with Tibet. And the way what they used to do with the different places, like in Europe actually, you'll have the emperor, his son marrying a princess from Tibet, and so on. One thing, and that's where we come into this thing about cultures and what is the all this propaganda concerning Tibet, and now how the Tibetan culture is being wiped out. It's the same we had with the beautiful Aztec culture, where they ripped out the hearts of people, right? And that is something good to praise. So the Tibetan culture was brutal. So what the Chinese are doing now is to do a lot of work regarding industrial development. So you have right now being built, supposed to be done by year 2000, what is it now, 2006, I believe, but I have to look it up for the right year, where they're building a railroad from Golmud. We have the Himalaya here, Golmud is here, and Lhasa is here. So they're building a railroad from Golmud up to Lhasa in Tibet, and it's a real treat. 4/5 of the railroad is in permafrost. That is, it's always frost. You have to make the railroad so that the rail cars, so that you have high pressure system like in airplanes, because it's that high. And you can imagine what a feat it is concerning how what to do technologically, what technological breakthroughs to make, to concerning machinery and how to do it in that. So they are. This is the first connection with Twain that is ever been. So they're taking that approach. They also want to build, think beginning 2009, but that all depends also what is happening internationally. They want to build the Da Xia, which is this, and they want to wait after they have built the railroad, which is a gigantic 2-kilometer waterfall up in the Himalayas, which can create a tremendous amount of energy. But one thing, I mean, people should know in connection with China that the reports you are getting concerning economic development are quite misleading. For almost a year now, there's been major power shortages in China, and you don't read it in the papers. I try to read 3 or 4 Chinese papers a day, 3 from mainland China and 1 from Taiwan, and it's nowhere to be seen. I found one article from Shanghai from October, just a little article where Shanghai municipalities are asking 3,000 companies to move a lot of their production to weekends because of power shortages. You have in most of China today in the cities, you have every day there is blackouts, not just brownouts, but blackouts. And people are being told minimum 2 days a week for shutdowns between 4 to 12 hours. So major bottlenecks. You also have problems. So this is what LaRouche means concerning taking things from outside and not really knowing where it comes from and what generated it. Like they wanted so badly to have foreign companies, so they have built operate transfer system where companies, so the Chinese will build everything, enlarge the port, build railroads and electrify roads and so forth, and then the foreign company can come in and have all this infrastructure built for them, and then they get tax breaks and so forth. So what the Chinese actually put in, and they're using cheap, dirt cheap labor, what they actually get out is much less when they put in from the foreign companies. They just want it so badly to get the foreign companies. And the get-rich ideology in China is very bad now. It's really hefty. The gap between the poor and the rich are growing very fast. I just want to mention here, because there's a lot of propaganda about China. And just take a step back and look at it from the very top. And then I always say to people, and think about yourself if you were in charge of China, what you would do. Well, of course, you would call LaRouche and say, okay, come here and help me. But for real, it's a tremendous country with tremendous, and they learned from a, one of the problems you have also, a lot of Chinese students, 10,000 of Chinese students go to Harvard, Chicago School of Economics, Yale, and so forth, all the fancy smancy stuff. And they're studying here and they're going back, and they're bad. They're bad for China. Think about what is being taught today in American universities, in particular the most prestigious one like Harvard and so forth. Yeah.
I was talking to a Chinese student in San Francisco the other day, and it got kind of heated when I brought up Taiwan. I was bringing it up in the context of the neocon. He was saying that most young people in China support military intervention to keep Taiwan.
I can tell you that is a real danger. There is a big danger that we can have a war, and again, that's all also defined by what we're doing here, for real, in a very direct way. There's a real danger that we can have a war over the Taiwan Strait before the end of 2007. And the calculations are that it has to be done before China has the Olympics and before we have the very crucial in 2008 and before we have the very crucial Shanghai cooperation meetings with further collaboration in 2010, that people that are against a unified China, they say themselves, if China gets too strong, we are going to have a unification. So there's a big, big manipulation from outside. They're trying to have, they've discussed for a long time, theater missile defense system between US, Japan, Taiwan, and they are really playing with fire. And the thing, in my estimate, if it had been so that the Chinese would have been left to themselves, I mean, one of the things you have now, for example, is that Taiwan businessmen, you have over 1 million of them, they're now living in mainland China. They have their own Taiwan schools, they have their hospitals and so forth, and they are pushing for reunification. And you are playing with fire in a very dangerous way if, like through Chen Shui-bian and Li Dunhui, really dangerous. The key thing is let the Chinese figure it out for themselves. It's my view that if you just allow the Chinese to figure it out themselves with closer collaboration and so forth, then it would not be a problem. Like the people that are for independence of Taiwan, they're the ones that don't want to have direct flights, direct mail, direct trade, because they're afraid that then there will be a... I have talked with a number of people from Taiwan, for example, that... I mean, I remember one guy, at one point, he was an economist, and he was, at one point, he was furiously independent. And then I saw him about a year later, and he had been on tour in mainland China, and he had been to Xinjiang province. This is fantastic. He called me Mrs. Rubinstein. This is fantastic, Mrs. Rubinstein. This is big. And the sky. And he was so excited about China that he wants to be... the sky in Xinjiang province should be fantastic. I was never there, so I don't know. The sky.
We look up at the sky.
So he just had realized, traveling in China and all the things that could be done and built, that this was his country. Not the little snotty island of Taiwan, right? But this big country, right? Snotty, it's tiny little island, right? It's the same culture. It has been one country, except for the Japanese invasion and occupation, for hundreds and hundreds of years. And as you could have, the idea is to have a very big autonomy, the biggest autonomy of all the places, including your own military.
Yes.
It's very dangerous. It's very dangerous. It's really being played up by outside, and it's much more than that. I actually gave a presentation a few months ago, which is on the LIM website, much more in detail also concerning Japan and so forth. You can go in; it'll give you more. Because I'm not really paying respect to your question, but it'll take a little bit too long to go into more detail, because you have to really look at some of the history leading up to it. Yes?
I was wondering, I was reading a slug in the briefing a little while ago, and it was talking about like all these Indian, Chinese generals going to India, because
mm-hmm.
they hadn't been there for a really long time, and mm-hmm. the relations are getting better. What were the bad relations?
This is you have, again, the British, a very long border between the Chinese and China and India. Don't forget that India was a colonial power, and this has been all manipulated from outside. The way it functions, I really learned a lot going to Asia, because in Europe, if you grow up and live in Europe, you know that the Germans don't like the French, the Poles don't like the Russians and the Germans, the Danes don't like the Swedes, and the Swedes don't like the Danes, and so forth. It's like all over. And even among friends, right, you can manipulate fights between the people of the different nationalities. That comes from old Kazakhs. I mean, you can go to certain parts of France where it's like you had the First World War right there. It's right in the countryside. You can still find the grenades. You're shown the knives which have a shape like a star. that was used to kill the people in the trenches that were left in the trenches in the First World War. And people talk about it, it's like it was yesterday, right? And you have all these towns turning towards Germany, which is like a fortification on one side and then a normal town on the other side. And so they're all old battles. So, and many of them manipulated from outside. So the Kazakhs are there. So you make it, so if you are an, if you are Anglo-Dutch manipulators, you make profiles, you know it. You make profiles of different nations, you can create tension and wars. Huh? So I thought, well, that's Europe. And then I go to Asia, and oh my God, I've talked with Chinese people who would insist there's not one good Japanese existing on this surface of the earth, okay? And the Koreans and the Japanese, and so it's really hefty, and that has been played. It's geopolitical manipulation of a heritage which goes from suffering and wars, earlier wars, which has been also been manipulated and which sits, it's like a Jewish children that came out of people that were concentration survivors. I mean, Germany. It's like Phil couldn't get a Volkswagen. His parents was upset when he got a Volkswagen because it's a German car. For me, that's pretty wild. But that's these Kazakhs, and that's the same thing. So the concerning geopolitical manipulation by the financial oligarchy is really quite something. And it's the same wherever you go. And that's what Sun Yat-sen wrote about. It's a really fantastic little book. Huh? We have, it's in English. It's easy to get in the library. Easy to get. It's a little book. Okay, what I'm going to do, yes, what I'm going to do is, this is three little clips that didn't function before. It's in connection with what China has actually been through after Sun Yat-sen, and this was, you remember, the panda flowers grow, then the Cultural Revolution, then the Great Leap Forward, where people died by the millions, and then the Cultural Revolution. And this is from 1979, and the clips should speak for themselves. That I talked a little bit about it because we couldn't get to folks at that time. So here's the three little clips.
No, 1, 2, and 3 is the order you
Yes,
decide.
Yes.
The Cultural Revolution started during the spring of 1990.
No, that's not the right one.
That's number one.
Well, then it's been changed. It's not number one. It's the little girl playing.
Here and play here. there's a difference. You understand? For me.
You want to draw?
Why was these youngsters so good and the older 19-year-old, 20, not so good? And here the old man that comes out now will say that.
At any international level, it's very, very high standard. From what we have seen,
the Cultural Revolution started during the spring of 1966. All of a sudden, in May, the storm broke out. I thought Beethoven, Mozart, Western music. I taught people to make violins. Those are the instruments belonging to the imperialists, belonging to the foreign devils, belonging to the Westerners. It was like a bad dream, like a nightmare. I was confined to a small room. That's not a room, that's a closet in the basement of the of the library, just under the stairs. It's a small castle without window, without light, without ventilation. And there is a septic tank in the under the floor, and a big pipe. The refuse comes from the toilets through that pipe into the septic tank, and smells very badly. I had to stay there for 14 months. And for lack of, because of the lack of oxygen, lack of air, my legs were swollen. I think the chief reason they did that to all the professors and teachers is just to get rid of us, because they want to get power, to get control of the conservatory, and to get control of the music. But during a period, I was not allowed to come out. I had to stay in the dark room all the time. Somebody would send me something to eat. I was allowed to come out for a few minutes every day to get a little water, to go to the toilet. And once my daughter came from Peking, she wanted to see me. And the Red Guard told me, your daughter wants to see you, but I allow you only 5 minutes to talk with her. And with his presence. So it was in the evening. He led me to a corner of the wall, and I saw my daughter in the dark with a granddaughter of 7 years. When I saw my granddaughter called me grandfather. I couldn't restrain my tears, because I was treated as a criminal. But sometimes we were treated as animals. Of our teachers died of by suicide, because they couldn't stand the humiliation and torture, especially the torture of the mind and the humiliation. Of course, we were beaten, we were kicked and beaten in many ways, but I think that's all right comparing with the humiliation. We were pitied as criminals, because we taught them Western music.
Alright. So get that from Mao to Mozart. You see the whole thing, it's very beautiful. So I guess we have soon dinner.